Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Real Talks. I'm your host, David Steele. Yeah, so sorry about the late start time, guys, but we're here. And as promised, we are going to be doing the spoiler cast for Guardians 3, and I thought I'd bring along a friend. So today we have Matthew Anderson with us, who actually went to go see it last night, I think he said.
It was Thursday night, I saw. Thursday afternoon.
So, yeah, it was interesting. And we're going to get to the box office in a little bit after, maybe, because it's interesting because the fact is that this is one of those films that everybody was hyped for, and for good reason. And, yeah, I mean, it's hitting right on the numbers. So, first and foremost, so what time, just curious, you said you went to the Thursday showing. What time did you see it?
So my plans were to see it as early as possible. And for my theater, it was 3 o'clock on Thursday. In fact, I'm pretty sure when I was going into my theater for Guardians, they were showing the last showings for Return of the Jedi, which had its whole one full week rerun they did.
And that was completely different for me.
Yeah, it was completely different. And I was thinking to myself, like, out of curiosity, I was like, all right, is there any, like, Return of the Jedi screenings playing? And I go on my phone, and I'm like, oh, there's only two showtimes. And literally the one that was I was going into the theater for had just let its audience out, I think. But, yeah, I went to see the 3, partly because I was just like, look, I want it. Not that I was like, oh, God, I'm dreading this, and I just want to get this over with. It was just more of like, look, I want to see this movie on the big screen without having anyone tell me about any spoilers, so... Or, you know, go on Twitter and find out spoilers for myself and so on. So I just thought, all right, go to 3 o'clock and that's that.
Yeah, no, I went to a 3 o'clock showing myself. As a matter of fact, I did a double feature. Speaking of Return of the Jedi, I actually did a double feature. So I went to the 12:15 of Jedi, and that got out with previews and everything, with trailers. As you can imagine, it's, you know, a good 20 minutes. So by the time that got out at like 2:45, that, you know, I had a 3 o'clock showing of Guardians, and just I walked right in, and it was perfect. And I saw it in IMAX, and it was just wow. I mean, it's just something, you know, there's such a difference, even because going from like the 2D with Jedi, and it was so much. I mean, I had seen the film probably 40 or 50 times before, but there was something different experiencing on the big screen. And by the way, guys, if you want to go back and check out, leave a link in the top of the page there. I did a 40th anniversary talking all about Return of the Jedi. Yeah, it was just a blast. So then I walked right into our Guardians. And I'm curious now, what trailers, I think we touched on this, what trailers did you get? Because I think they might have been different for you than me.
So since I saw the 2D showing screening of it, you probably didn't get some of these trailers. The Fast 10 trailer I got, The Flash, it was the newer trailer that came out for both of them. Hunger Games prequel, whatever it's called, I can't even remember.
Songbirds and Snakes.
Yeah. Trailer for Oppenheimer, which we may talk about later on.
Yeah.
Maybe off air, we'll see. Indiana Jones 5, mm-hmm. The Haunted Mansion, and The Marvels.
Okay, yeah, I got everything except Haunted Mansion 1. And that Oppenheimer trailer, oh my God.
Yeah,
3D.
It's not gonna be in 3D. I don't think.
Not 3D. Just seeing it on the big screen.
Oh yeah.
I can only imagine what it would have been like in 3D, but like seeing it on that IMAX screen, whoa.
Yeah.
Crazy. Anyways, more on that later, guys. But yeah, so this is the end of trilogies are always interesting because, you know, we always talk about, is it gonna be good? How is it gonna wrap up? And you know, all the anticipation was there because, let's face it, the last 4 or 5 films have been average. So your average take home on opening weekend, it's been about around $156 million. And I mean, I'm going back all the way to, you know, opening weekend at Doctor Strange, Multiverse of Madness. You've had Thor: Love and Thunder. You have Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. All these. So this was like, and then we're like, eh. And then you just had Ant-Man, which came out in February, and was an absolute disaster for them, relatively speaking. It only made $500 million globally. It was one of the worst performing films for Marvel for a lot of different reasons.
Yeah.
And they said, okay, we have to have a win here. And just by the win or no, what did you think? So first of all, what were your first impressions once the film was done?
Well, first off, making $500 million is not a sign of
making. Let me say this. Relatively speaking, for their box office, they're accustomed. No, that's it. As a matter of fact, I just did a story today about how Super Mario just did it domestically, and that's for different reasons. But nonetheless, it's still impressive. It's very impressive. But comparatively to when you have other films do 6, 7, 8, they needed something like this. So go ahead.
Sure. Yeah, no, it's definitely a case of, like, you know, marketing, and, you know, you got to cover the marketing costs, and it had, like, a lot of competition it was going up against. Like, Avatar 2 was still, like, you know, ranking in the dough at the box office. But, yeah, as far as Guardians 3 goes, so I don't know about you, David, but I hadn't seen the first two Guardians films in the longest time. I think the first one I ended up seeing all the way through since, like, 2014 when it came out. And then even for the second one, I hadn't seen it since like Thursday. And it's not really necessarily, I mean, part of it is because most of these Marvel films are kind of, you know, they are a bit disposable, where they're like, you know, they're good movies, they're entertaining, but they're not ones that I'm like racing back to the theater or like, you know, racing on Disney Plus to like rewatch over and over again all the way through. I may watch parts of it, of these films, but never. It's been a while since I've actually like wanted to sit down and watch them by myself without having to show anyone else these movies. But yeah, so what I did was I rewatched the first two Guardians films, and I'm so glad I did that, because it made me appreciate not just what James Gunn had done so well with the first two films in terms of setting up some of these character arcs, which we'll get into in the film, but also paying off some of these character arcs too. And the other thing I noticed too, and I'm not sure if you'll agree with me on this, or maybe you will, and we'll probably go more into the discussion. But the one aspect I liked about what Gunn has done so far with these Guardians films is that, for the most part, you know, I've already established that he does a really good job setting up the arcs and paying them off by the third movie or continuing them. And particularly with this guy right here, Rocket Raccoon. But the other thing I really liked about his writing, in terms of the way he writes these Guardian films, is that not only in the character development in each of these films, but even in the way the humor is done, it's very much like some of them are genuinely funny. And I think a part of that comes from the fact that he has a lot of setup and payoffs. You know, he's setting up said jokes and then pays them off either by the end of the film and whatnot. You know, the biggest one actually was from the second film, where it showed James Gunn using the song, the Fleetwood Mac song, The Chain. And he's using that in volume 2 when Peter Quill decides to go off and, you know, form a bond with his long lost dad. And he's leaving the other half of the Guardians on some stranded planet, where, and then it's played later on again when Peter Quill realizes that that his dad is not who he seems to be. And he, you know, ends up beating the shit out of him with his powers that he has. And some of that is very much carried into the third film, too. I didn't even mention my quick thoughts on the film overall, but anyway, so leading to that, to what I'm trying to say is, I like the third movie. I think it is a good, satisfying enough conclusion to some of these characters and their arcs, and it has some of that clever, you know, setup and payoff writings that the first two had. Maybe not as much as some of the other stuff that we'll get into a bit more, particularly with Cosmo the dog. I thought was really kind of irritating. But there's other moments in the film I really liked. I liked Rocket's backstory and how that whole arc was handled. I really liked how, again, they were concluding these arcs and had some really good action scenes. There's an impressive one-er in a hallway scene. I won't go into right now, but it's a really fun moment in the film, for me at least. And yeah, it was just an entertaining movie. I'm seeing a lot of complaints online, which we'll probably get into more of, the fact that people are very much like, this is just an imitation of what Gunn had done with the first two Guardians. And I'm like, not really. I mean, we also have to keep in mind that James Gunn had probably wrote a good chunk of the story before he was fired from Guardians. If anyone doesn't remember, he has since apologized, by the way. And so all the Guardians, particularly that of, I remember Dave Bautista was on a record saying that he will never work with Disney ever again if they don't let James Gunn complete his trilogy. And he even went on record to say, like, even Gunn has apologized about this. And, you know, like I mentioned, all the Guardians cast members, I think Selma Blair was another actress who signed a petition as well, saying, like, you know, reinstate Gunn back. And so Kevin Feige was allowed to bring him back on. And he said, on top of that, we'll let you finish your trilogy and get to do a holiday special for Disney Plus. And he said, all right, that's great. I'll do that. But you got to let me finish the Suicide Squad, which was just in the middle of filming, which it was like 2019, 2020, I think it was when that was coming out. So, yeah. So I don't know. Like, I like with all that said, and like, I thought it was like about on par with the first two in terms of like consistent quality, like bringing us what we liked about the first two. It didn't really seem like he was rehashing the old days. It just seemed like he was doing, like, again, like a good enough job concluding the so-called trilogy. Yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was entertaining.
Yeah, no, it's so hard when you know, I was on a space the other day and I said this. I mean, it's one of those things where when the Guardians of the Galaxy first came out in 2014, by the way, that was, you know, so people forget about this. Okay, we're almost 10 years removed from this. But here's the thing. 2013 had a film that people consider very lackluster, and that's Thor: The Dark World. And the MCU is, for lack of a better word, in trouble. And that being said, what ended up happening was you had this movie come out, okay, first, okay, in Captain America: Winter Soldier. And that really put it back on the map. Okay, because of a multitude of reasons. You had the political spy angle. Okay, it was a sequel. It was, you know, it was action-packed. But more importantly, you had one of the biggest names, or arguably the biggest actors in the last, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, make the very first guest star. And that was Robert Redford playing Alexander Pierce. So when you bring him on board, they go, oh, wow, that really gives us some legitimacy. Then when you have the success of that, and then James Gunn comes out and brings us a movie, frankly, like I said the other day, there were B characters, probably more like C characters. Now, unless you were an avid comic book reader, you really didn't know much about him. And that was the Guardians of the Galaxy. And the Guardians of the Galaxy, and I watched it the other night all the way through, it was, you know, I put out a tweet earlier that night saying I could see why this is considered one of the best MCU films out there. I mean, it's a top five, top six, top seven MCU film because it has heart, it has character development, it has action. It's moving the plot, the macro plot, okay? Yeah. Forward, and it does so many things well, and it's comedic. So when you have, 2014, like I said, was a great year. So when that is a huge success, then what ends up happening is everybody's looking forward to Volume 2. Volume 2, for what it was very good. It was very good. And, I mean, not the level of what, you know, the first one was, because it's so hard to duplicate. So when he says, okay, we're going to make a third one and close this thing out, that's it. And it was amazing. So also considering, you know, all these years later, you have these lackluster, subpar, and not box office wise, but just, you know, critics, you know, people. It was okay. So when you have this, say, okay, this is going to really do this. It's one of those things where, yeah, this is just going to hit. It's going to be a home run. And now they are A characters. And the other thing, too, is, and this is what this movie had, stakes. It had some big, big stakes. And when we see this, you go, oh, okay. And you really start to appreciate it. So, I mean, it ties everything together, like you said, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things where we're seeing characters from the second film come into the third film, and it's kind of like a wrap-up. Overall, yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, was it as good as 2014? No. It's so hard to duplicate. But it had everything you talked about. It had the comedic humor. It had the action. It had the stakes. So
I actually prefer this movie over the first one because I remember even when I saw the first movie at the time at the drive-in, whatever it was, on opening weekend, I did remember enjoying the first movie, but I wasn't in love with it. And I think Patrick Gertz from Double Toasted, who's no longer on the show, I think he brought up a really good point as to why I couldn't get attached to the first one as much as everyone else was. And part of it was the fact that I wish it got a lot goofier and didn't stick to the whole formula of we got to stop the bad guy with the magic rock destroying the planet. Whereas the second film, I liked, even though it's a lot more flawed than the first film, I like that it was able to be a lot more goofier, kind of like a Looney Tunes special almost. And even though it has a lot more flaws than the first movie, it's not nearly as formulaic as the first one, though. And much like the first and third film, Volume 2 did have a lot of comedic moments. It was like the comedy was very hit or miss. But for unlike the first one, when the comedic moments landed for Volume 2, it really hit for me. Like, I remember rewatching the second one this past, like I said, the first two films this past weekend, and I was surprised how much like I was laughing to the point where, you know, my guts practically busting open just because of how hilarious it was. Like when Rocket puts Yondu and the whole gang through like these like time jumps, and instead of going through 50, they go through like 700 of them. Like, I thought that whole sequence was great. Like, everything about like Rocket and Yondu itself, I thought was great. And there were other jokes too about it, about that second one, I thought were just really funny. And yeah, I mean, as far as this third one goes, like in terms of where I would rank it, I would say the second Guardians film is still my favorite of the three. And I think the third one is probably my second favorite, just again, because of how they handled Rocket's arc, who is the majority of the character. Like, even though he's not in the present day sequences with our other Guardians, such as Drax and Quill and Groot and Mantis and Nebula, he's still we still get to explore his past and, you know, the tragedies that he goes through with him being, you know, experimented on by the high revolutionary.
Yeah, character. Evolutionary. Yeah.
Evolutionary. Okay. So I got that right. And yeah, it was pretty cool seeing that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because we really knew about all of the other origin stories, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we really knew where Peter came from because that was established in, you know, the first film. We knew where Gamora came from, even though that was eventually, we saw her backstory in her as a child in Infinity War. We do know that she was, you know, daughter of Thanos. We know about
adopted daughter
of Thanos. We do know that, you know, Drax had a family. Okay. I mean, even though and Groot and Rocket have always been a tag team. So it was one of those things where we had never really seen where Rocket came from. And that's what this film completely examines. So, you know, the two villains that you had made mention of course, you know, the High Evolutionary and Adam Warlock. And so it's one of those things where, you know, talking about the villains for a minute, I didn't mind the villains. One thing I have seen about High Evolutionary, which, you know, thinking about it now, is he just repeated the same thing for almost an hour and a half. You know, we have to get this creature back. We have to get this creature back. We have to, you know, get this number back.
Yeah.
And so there were stakes, like I said, and the biggest thing was that, you know, they had to get this card and that was it. And you felt like, you know, at some point or another that Rocket wouldn't make it. And, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, and that's what gets you, because he's there on that table and he's got that thing attached to his nose. And it's like, okay, you know, and you see all the monitors around him, and is he really going to make it? I thought, but getting back to that, like the first 5 minutes, I mean, let me talk about that for a minute, because the way he introduces this movie is incredible. So we see, and, you know, I just did a story today about how there were 3,600 VXF shots in this film. But more importantly, they actually studied, like, you know, raccoons and everything else, because they wanted to get, like, the tears right in the eyes and everything else. And when we see the beginning of the film, the first 5 minutes, like I said, the first thing that you see is like a baby raccoon. And then it morphs into an adult rocket. And you're like, oh, wow. And that really gave you a good idea of where it was going to go and how, you know, what had happened to him and everything else. Yeah. And I mean, you can talk more about this, but I think the voice acting here, it's easy enough to be on a soundstage and be like, oh, you know, and deliver your lines. It's another thing to be behind a microphone, you know, and maybe there's somebody else talking to you, but to actually, you know, deliver your lines just by your voice. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I think Bradley Cooper, and I was just, even Vin Diesel, I mean, saying three words, but being able to say them in a multitude of ways is so, you know.
Are you telling me that Vin Diesel has range as an actor? Is that what you're telling me?
What I'm saying is it's difficult to have, what I'm saying is that I think that for what it's worth, for those three words, yes, he does. I mean, well, because it's very hard.
Yeah,
because you know.
Yeah. It's very tough for someone to have, like, you know, a really great voice performance and to have a great, you know, some great live action work done. But it's I can tell you this right now, and we're not even going to talk about this on this episode, but it's Bradley Cooper's year. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Like, he's got spoilers. He's in Dungeons and Dragons with that really good cameo. He's in, what was it, the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, which he, you know, practically steals the show, and he's got Maestro coming out. Like, I would be shocked. I'm probably going to be eating my words for this, maybe, but I would be shocked if he does not go home with an Oscar for, you know, because of this. Not for this movie, but I'm saying he's probably going to get it for Maestro. But just because of, like, you know, it's the kind of, like, this is the kind of thing that I think could help his chances of winning an Academy Award. Because we have seen actors in the past where they're like, oh, wow, you're having, like, a really killer year being in these, like, great supporting roles and showcasing your strengths as an actor. And look at that. You're actually giving a really solid performance in this other Oscar film. We'll talk more about Maestro later.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just...
But regardless of, like, Bradley Cooper is, like, really good as Rocket. And I've always been of the opinion that he's been one of my favorites, if not my favorite character of the MCU. Definitely my favorite of the Guardians, easily. But rewatching the first two Guardians films, I've just realized, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, this is – he's easily my favorite MCU character. Just because I like that – for some odd reason, even when I first saw it, I always considered Rocket and Groot almost like this version's Han Solo and Chewbacca. In that, but except, like, Han Solo has, like, a really tragic backstory that we don't know about. And the other thing I liked about it too was that, going back to setup and payoffs, James Gunn did a really good job, like, cleverly setting up some of the clues of the first two Guardians in terms of what happened with Rocket. Because in the first film, if anyone remembers, he was at the bar, you know, pissed drunk, ready to shoot a blowaway Drax with his gun. And he talks about how he's, you know, he was being torn apart over and over again. And, you know, he was being called, you know, all these names like vermin and rodent. And it's really, like, fucking heartbreaking to see him do that, to hear about him. And then even with the second one, with Yondu pointing out, like, you're me. You want to why? Because I did all this shit that you're doing right now. Being, like, the tough guy who's, you know, not afraid of anything. But deep down, you're scared. And I really like that he was able to pay that off in the third movie.
Absolutely. And that's what made this, at least the first half for me, okay, amazing. Because, as I said, there were stakes. And when you have stakes that, You know, because let's face it, you may live, you know, somebody may live or die. We all know this, but it's because you've been invested for these last two films, okay, that you really care if Rocket lives or dies.
Yeah.
And so his story really dictates what he went through and yep. how you feel about him. And so, you know, whether it's, so I think part of it too was the heist. I mean, let's talk about, so that they figure out, by the way, that was a really cool, for the two scenes, one of the scenes he was in, you know, Sylvester Stallone came back, which was nice to see. I mean, there you go. I mean, you don't get Sylvester Stallone if, you know, somebody like a Redford doesn't do it 8 years earlier. Anyway, so, but that was fun to see. So you had Sylvester Stallone, even though, you know, he was in one scene, basically
where he's practically like slurring his lines like I am the law.
Yeah, so but it was cool to see. And the other thing it was interesting to see too was Gamora, and how Gamora, I'm really happy that they did not try to get, you know, have Quill get the girl again.
I am too. And I'm gonna, I know a lot of people out there, and I've already followed enough people on Twitter who are really pissed off with how they practically like fridged her in Infinity War. I totally get the complaints. I totally do, because the fact that James Gunn set up the Gamora and Peter, their relationship from the first and second film so well, to where that Infinity War was, you know, supposed to be their way of saying like bye. You know, bye-bye, Gamora. We don't give a shit about you. And I totally get that. But at the same time, though, I like that James Gunn, with the limitations of what within this universe that you're building, that you're doing, he was able to have a good enough conclusion. And we'll get to that in just a second. But the other thing, too, is that, like, I know I should be, like, you know, people are probably asking me, like, why aren't you more pissed about the fact that, you know, they didn't have the prime Gamora come back into play? And they have this alternate reality. He's got to deal with the scraps. Well, the thing is, though, is that when you're signing on to do a franchise like this, you have to pay. You have to, no matter how creative and how cool your set of toys are going to be, and you know how much fun you make the playground is. At the end of the day, it's not your property. It's Disney's and Marvel's. And I know it. You know, hey, yeah, I know, and I agree. It's shitty too that what they did with Gamora and such. But I really like the fact that they were able to, again, within the limitations that Gunn had, I like that they didn't have a romance to begin with. In fact, ever since Endgame and Infinity War, Peter Quill has kind of been at a very depressing state. We didn't see a lot of that in Infinity War and Endgame because there's a lot of shit blowing up and Thanos is coming in to get these Infinity Stones and kill all the world, or at least wipe half of the world from existence. Whereas we saw a little bit of Peter Quill being, you know, that moping kind of character with, what was it, in the holiday special, and a little bit of this, to where, you know, you could see, like, he desperately misses Gamora and,
well, even, you know, at the wants to relive
the old days. Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah, totally.
Even at the beginning of the film, like, you know, we see a Peter Quill, okay? I mean, you know, he's playing, like, Rocket's playing with his Walkman. And, yeah. You know, he comes in, he, you know, changes it, and he walks in, and Quill is just with his head on the table,
yeah.
Okay, because he was drunk,
yeah,
and he's like, drunk. Give me that Walkman, and he stumbles, and they have to put him to bed,
yeah.
Because he's so depressed, because he's so, you know, messed up, that,
he's so fixated on thinking, the way to solve my guilt and the way to solve my depression is if I got a chance to come hook up with Gamora, even though she has no memories, no idea. In fact, her version, she came in a timeline to where she never even met the Guardians of the Galaxy yet.
Well,
they were, you know, she was like a few days off from meeting them. So she has no idea what the hell Peter Quill sees in her to begin with. And the other thing I really liked about not just how the fact that they, you know, Peter Quill acknowledges that, like, you know, like, obviously, like, you know, this relationship that her and I can have, this version of Gamora can have, and I could have, is just, it's not going to be recapturing the, you know, any kind of relationship to begin with, like the old days. But on top of that, one thing, one of the very few details I actually noticed again, it shows how much James Gunn was kind of paying attention to some of his characters from the first two Guardians. Is let me ask you this. Remember in the first movie when Gamora and the whole gang, they found out about the Infinity Stone wiping out the entirety of the universe and it blew up the collector's shop. And what did Gamora do? She told the gang, we have to give this to the Nova Corps to protect the people.
Yeah.
And in this film, when they come into a situation where they have to go after, they have to save the kids from the burning ship, she decides, no, fuck those kids. I want to get out of here and go off on my own adventure. Like, we got to go. And it's really like the inverse of what the Prime Gamora ended up being. Because again, she never really got to that moment in her life to where she's like, why should I care for any of these people? You know? And, you know, the way that this Gamora is, she, you know, all she's been is a Ravager since she got to this new time realm or world or whatever. And, you know, she doesn't know any of the stuff of like saving the world. She's pretty much where Peter Quill was in the first Guardians of like, who gives a shit about saving the people? We just want to make a good buck out of this.
Well, no, I mean, even it was great that, you know, I mean, within even this scene here, okay, he was able to rehash in like a 20-second scene,
yeah,
all of the stuff that, you know, had happened and, you know, was able to get a joke out of it. You know, and was, you know, one of those things where, because it's, you know, and I gotta say this, Karen Gilliam was awesome in this movie.
She's good. Yeah.
She was, she got so much more. I mean, not that she didn't get more in the others, but she got so much more in this that, and especially Mantis too. And that was so cool to see. But yeah, no, I really appreciate the fact that the boy didn't get the girl and she fell back in love with him, and she said it, you know, countless times that I don't know what you saw in me, you know, and everything else,
but I'm not her, you know, whoever. Exactly, you imagine,
not her. Yeah. And I mean, she eventually came to respect him at the end of the film, but it was, yeah, more of, you know, I'm not her. And so, yeah, that was really good to see. Yeah, I mean,
Even too, like, Peter Quill has also developed a little bit since the first Guardians. Like, he's not really thinking the way of the Ravengers of, like, you know, fuck the people, we gotta save the world. Okay, anyways. So, it was very much, he's also matured a bit since the first Guardians film. You know, he's not the, you know, character that he used to be. And, yeah, no, I liked all that, you know. Yeah, and to add on with Mantis, though, I'm pretty sure one of James Gunn's intentions for that holiday special was he wanted to create a little bit more for Drax and Mantis to do in the story, because they weren't given a whole lot with Infinity War and Endgame. They were treated more like side characters, and understandably so. There's like 10,000 characters you got to get through. Only so many could fill up the screen time. And yeah, so that was kind of cool to see Mantis and Drax go on their own adventure in that, and then you see them teaming up again in this one. So yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before, like, I thought I'm glad, you know, once Rocket, that whole thing was resolved. I don't know, did you feel like the movie dropped off a little bit, or was it me? Because you know, Rocket was okay. And look, I understand you can only do that for so long, and yeah, then they go after the big bad, and that's where they, you know, the ship basically starts to shoot off into space, and
yeah,
you know, I mean, did you feel it starting to tail off there, or was that just me?
I think it was just you, because I actually thought they were going to kill him off, not on the surgery table. I thought they were going to kill him off at the end of the film, the very end,
okay,
when he's, you know, face to face with the
High Evolutionary.
High Evolutionary. I thought he was going to get killed off there, because I don't know why, but I for some reason, ever since James Gunn had been teasing what the original intentions were for this third Guardian, since he was fired, and then he said, well, don't worry, we'll get to the third film eventually. I got a couple ideas I want to get through, and one of them is involving finishing off Rocket's arc, and I'm like, oh, he's going to kill him off. Okay. And you know, surprisingly enough, they didn't. But still, I was still thinking to myself, okay, let's see where this is going to go. But I don't know. I was actually entertained through a good chunk of that third act. You know, like when Peter Quill puts on Beastie Boys and
Oh yeah, that whole sequence.
They're all gearing up, and yeah, Rocky got a couple of badass moments where I was just like, "Fuck yeah!" Like I literally like raised my fist in the air, like, "Yeah, awesome."
I think that was, well, no, even that whole everybody, and that was the other thing too, right? Every single person got their own moment in this film. Every single one of them, whether it was Peter, whether it was Mantis, whether it was, you know, I love, you know, talk about payoffs. They, you know, yeah. Drax is basically, he's the one talking to the children.
Yep.
Like they understand. And it was just, it was cool to see that whole thing come full circle because, well, you know. Mm-hmm.
Not just that, but also the fact that Drax had pointed out how, I think he mentioned in the second or first film, how when he met his wife, he knew that she was the one because she wasn't dancing around like all the idiots were. And what happens at the end of the film? He starts dancing like an idiot and it, you know, completed that arc. And I thought, all right, that's kind of cool. Yeah. But no, I don't know. I had a whole lot of fun with it. The one other criticism I've been hearing people telling me about or seen online was that a lot of the people thought that the film was a bit too dark. And I get it if you're an animal lover. Obviously, it's going to be a bit depressing to see what happens to Rocket's friends when they're brutally shot and even tortured with some of them. But I actually thought, even though as predictable as that was, I knew that they weren't going to get out of that situation or they were going to get killed off somehow, I still thought it was effective enough to where when Rocket is scratching the shit out of the High Imperium.
Evolutionary.
Once again, okay, I'm forgetting.
The High Evolutionary, that's okay.
When he's scratching the shit out of him, I'm like, God damn, like, holy shit. I mean, he's justified, honestly, because of all the torturing that he does, you know, like, you know, because he's such a perfectionist. He's like, you guys think you're going to go into the new world? Sorry, you know? Yeah. And then he's like, and then, yeah, he kills him like in cold, you know, kills his friend in cold blood. I'm like, fuck yeah, tear that face off. And it was even great when Rocket got his moment, which I forgot the one, even though there's a lot of other like the setup and payoffs within its own film. Like I mentioned, I did not like the Cosmo dog thing a whole bunch. But the other thing I did like about the film, and I completely forgot about it, was when Rocky was testing out the gravity boots. At the very beginning of the film, mm-hmm. He's testing out the gravity boots. Okay, so, anyways, what else was I going to say? Yeah, so he tests out the gravity boots, and then right as he's being, you know, thrown up by the guy with the mystic powers or whatever, he ends up pushing the boots, and then he pulls out his gun. He's like, "The name's Rocket, Rocket Raccoon," and I'm like, "Yeah!" And it was great that they all got their moment to beat the shit out of him, and then Gamora stabbed him. But going back to what I was saying though, with that, I didn't think it was as dark as people had been, you know, telling me it was going to be, and I think part of it is because it served a necessary point to the whole movie. In terms of why Rocket is the way he is, why he is such a loner, why he doesn't open up to people, why he, you know, he doesn't have that much of a big heart as some of the other characters were until he met the Guardians. And that sort of, you know, filled in the patchet, what was missing from him when he broke out of his first ever, you know, performed his ever first prison break. And yeah, no, overall, I thought that all of that was done really well. And again, I'm reiterating this over and over again. I didn't think it was as needlessly dark as something like a Tim Burton film was with like Batman Returns, where it's just like, what are you doing here? Like, why are we being unnecessary? Why are we being dark for the sake of being dark, you know, where it's just like, let's throw the penguin baby off a bridge and into the water because he's deformed and disgusting. And, you know, all these things. And I'm like, why are we doing this shit? I don't get it. There's no purpose to this. But here it serves a purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think once again, empathy. You start to, when you see what the High Evolutionary is doing, okay, and you understand why he's doing it, you really start to go and you start to empathize with Rocket and go, oh. And then when, you know, as you may mention, when he kills everybody, you know, when he kills all his friends, you know, it's like, okay, now I'm going to do whatever I can to you. And, yeah. You know, the part I thought was a little predictable was when, you know, we see, you know, there's a big white light and he sees Lila and they're talking. I kind of figured, you know, they said, oh, well, can I come with you? Yeah, sure. But not now. I'm like,
okay. Yeah.
I mean, we've seen this in several different. I mean, I was just
Deadpool
watching
Deadpool 2.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I was going to reference. It was like, okay. And we've seen that. I'm like, okay, that's fine. No big deal. At that point, I knew he was going to come back. But once he did, it really started. I did like, too, the fact that it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine for, you know, you had some infighting, so to speak. Yeah. Between everybody, between, you know, Mantis and Drax and you know,
Nebula,
all these other people, Nebula. And that was good to see because you don't want to make it like, oh, okay, everything's hunky-dory here. No, yeah. It wasn't. Because
they're fighting like a family as they
were. Exactly.
As Drax pointed out, they were not friends, we're family.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was one of those things where I think that became very evident. Let's talk about the cutscenes real quick.
The after-credit scenes?
The after-credit scenes. What did you think of them, and were they funny to you? And because there's an article here I want to get to it's a little interesting because it kind of wraps it up. But what did you think about the cutscenes?
I don't know. Like, the two after-credit scenes, well, the first one being that Rocket is now the leader of the Guardians, which now that it's funny because when the one thing I always credit Marvel really – the Marvel Cinematic Universe has done really well is that through these movies, they made me give a shit about their characters and understand, like, at least the basics of who these characters are, even if they adapt them very differently from the source material. They're like, okay, I may get, like, a general idea of who they are. It may not be exactly the same with the comics, but it's adjusted enough to fit the movies that they're going for to where you care about these characters. And the one thing I was really impressed by with the Marvel stuff was particularly with the Guardians. Like I said, I did not know I would give a shit about a talking raccoon and a big like tree trunk that's all he says is "I am Groot." That's it. But through these films alone, I've actually given a shit about them a lot more than I would have before. And it was cool to see Rocket being the leader of the Guardians because Peter Quill, we didn't even mention this, Quill has decided he needs to go back to Earth to find his family because he's, you know, he hasn't gone back to Earth since Endgame. And that was only because to stop Thanos. He never got a chance to hang around other than to go to Tony's funeral and pick up Thor to go on their own adventures. And they dropped him off in Thor, Love and Thunder. But no, it was cool to see Rocket there. It was who was the guy? Sean Gunn's. It was the Sean Gunn's character. I can't remember his name.
Yeah,
but it was him. And there was like a random girl, and then Adam Warlock, which we didn't even mention in the movie. You know, he was fine. Like he's very much a dumb character, but there were a couple times where it was like, wow, okay, this is a little funny how dumb he is. Like he was told to like, you know, show him we made business, and he just
incinerates the guy.
And I'm like, oh damn, yeah. Remind me to go to loop around back around to that the violent stuff after we go over these credits. But
yeah.
But as far as the after credits go, I thought that was good. It was nice, you know, the play "Come and Get Your Love." That was kind of cool. And then the other post credit scene was with Quill having
breakfast and his grandfather.
With his grandfather, yeah. I thought that was a nice scene. I thought, okay, that was cool. Yeah, you know.
The reason I bring this up, okay, is because this came from Variety. And so what they were talking about is that not only does a post-credit scene suggest more sequels yet to announce, but all of the particular ones that they have out there. So basically what it goes into is I'll just briefly, by this point it's no secret that Marvel's secret or studios has lost some of its luster in its post-Avengers Endgame era. Between the MCU's rapid expansion and Disney Plus, and the exit stars like Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, and the late Chadwick Boseman, the Marvel saga has often felt once too much sprawl without a center. It's a problem that Guardians 3 is particularly ill-equipped to address. For one, the film is wholly disconnected from everything else that's happened in the MCU post-Endgame. There's not a whisper of Kang in the multiverse or incursions or hilariously Thor, even the Guardians make a special appearance that you made mention in Thor Love and Thunder last summer.
Yeah.
For another, the Guardians themselves, at least as audiences have grown to know them and love them, are also leaving the MCU. Between Zoe Saldana and Dave Bautista making it clear they're done with their respective roles, and writers James Gunn departing to go run DC Studios. These are, to be clear, great assets moving forward. Volume 3 in a sense of creative freedom and melancholy and Marvel titles have rarely enjoyed. In fairness, the film doesn't snap the Guardians completely either. So it talks about the post-credit scenes. Okay, so here are some of the... And by the way, I've got a thought about that as soon as I'm done with this. So they talk about the different post-credit scenes or sequels you could have. Okay, so we're going to get it. You know, over the last 21 months, Marvel has used their trademark post-credit scenes to tease as many as six or more upcoming movies. Yeah. They are a sequel or sequels to Shang-Chi, okay, which we kind of figured we were going to get, okay, a sequel to Eternals, a sequel to Multiverse of Madness, a sequel to Love and Thunder, a sequel to Black Panther Wakanda Forever, and now a sequel or sequels to Guardians of the Galaxy 3 that involves a newly assembled Guardians and the exploits of Star-Lord. None of these prospective feature films have addressed officially by Marvel Studios. Nevertheless, Marvel's been a studio to make an idle promise. So basically it goes, so here's where it gets tricky. Marvel Chief Kevin Feige has made it clear Secret Wars will conclude the multiverse saga in much of the same way Endgame did Infinity Saga. And to date, there are only three open release dates for Marvel properties. Secret Wars is set to expect to premiere May 1st of 2026. And those that dates might change. I think this is all relative prior to this.
Yeah.
July 25th, 2025, November 26th, 2025, and February 13th, 2026. Of course, some of the aforementioned sequels could be pulled in the event of Secret Wars and its ascendance 2025's Kang Dynasty. Other than maybe a part of the Disney show instead, but the overall effect remains too much muchness. Like a kid who keeps stacking a tile of toys. So basically, here's the thing. What it's going on to say is that, A, you have too many titles that you're teasing. And B, and it wasn't even talking about the strike, okay? But now that you may mention that, okay, it's one of those things where, you know, I hope that they do something about this because they have so much stuff. You know, I've always said this, their bread and butter, okay, has always been and will continue to be their feature films. All of these Disney Plus shows, like Loki, and, you know, WandaVision and everything else.
Secret Invasion.
Those are all icing on the cake for them.
Yeah.
Okay. The fact is, they made their money. They made their billions of dollars from their feature films.
Yeah.
Iron Man, Thor, Captain America, whatever. And that's where they need to go back and really do what they need to do. Now, if you want to introduce a character like a Miss Marvel every now and then to have it premiere in November, that's cool.
Yeah.
But you don't need to. The problem with Phase 4 was, as Kevin said, okay, they were, quote, introductory character, okay, like a Shang-Chi, like an Eternals. No Way Home was spectacular. But the problem, because of a lot of things, the story, you had, you know, nostalgia there, everything else. Now, you're at a point where you have so much IP out there and you've done so many other things. What do you do? And I think that's something that needs to be addressed, especially considering Bob Iger, okay, he's come out when he took over the helm a couple months ago saying we don't need 3 and 4 sequels for all this stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see if and when all this stuff's going to get taken care of. If it's going to get taken care of, and if it does, how is it going to be? By a streaming show, which would be a smaller production. You're not doing as much, you know, the special effects, or is it going to be a feature film? And I think they need to go, because otherwise you're convoluted.
Yeah, it's not just that, but it's also the fact that we've noticed, especially on the TV shows, that these visual effects houses the last summer or so have been bombarding us with news, shitty news, about the fact that Marvel has really, really put them through the ground, through the ringer and through the ground of like, we need like, you know, as many visual effects shot as like a movie is, and we want it all done in like an impossible timeline.
Today, okay, that has this film, Guardians 3, has 3,000 visual effects shots.
And 3,000. It would be fine if it was a movie or two every couple of years, but it's now, it's now the movies, it's now the TV shows, they're all being interchangeable, like they're doing it like, oh, we got to do them all back to back. Oh, we don't have enough time to finish the visual effects on She-Hulk. We gotta have them working
on Black Panther. I forgot about She-Hulk.
You know? Yeah, exactly. No one remembers.
So,
and on top of that too, it's not just how are they going to solve this, it's what are they setting up to? Because even though, you know, say what we want about the earlier stages of the MCU, they were setting up to something big. They were setting up the Tesseract, you know, with Loki. And they were setting that up for the first Avengers film. And when we got to that post-credits scene, it's like, okay, if we do more, here's what we're setting up. And it's Thanos. Thanos we're going to set up really well. And they kept cock-teasing us for years and years. And be like, when are we getting goddamn Thanos? And then when he comes in with the gauntlet, with all the Infinity Stones, it's like, okay, now we got bigger stakes going on here. And now we're kind of going backwards to where it's like, okay, what are you guys setting up? Like, it's one thing if you're just going to do introduction characters, but there's no real setup to where.
Well, I think what ended up happening was, okay, Phase 4 didn't show anything. The only thing that you saw of it was Kang in the Loki series. Okay, and that was another big problem that I had, and everybody, not everybody, but quite a few people I'm sure have, is all of these shows are, quote, recommended viewing. So, for example, I didn't see WandaVision going in. I knew what the Darkhold was and everything else.
Yeah.
But I had not seen WandaVision going into Multiverse of Madness. So I kind of knew that she was a villain. That being said, you now have to sit down and watch all of this content just to get caught up to, okay, what is going on in the feature films. Otherwise, you don't have an idea. Yeah. And the thing is that reason why I think they put Kang in Ant-Man is they said, which would obviously didn't work out for them.
Yeah, know, for both reasons in the film and off screen for reasons that we've already addressed so many times.
So that being said, what ended up happening was they shoehorned him in. Okay. Now, mind you, some of the scenes that he had with Michelle Pfeiffer were great, but for the villain, they said, oh, we need to introduce this guy as soon as possible. And so when it didn't work, you're like, now, because of everything that's transpired, okay, Monday is going to be a very interesting day because Monday is his Jonathan Majors court date.
Okay.
So, you know, while they'll be getting a win with Guardians, May 8th is, you know, the clock's ticking. So I'm really, really curious. Don't be shocked, okay, if maybe that day or 24 hours later, you hear about either A, other casting being done for Kang, or B, he gets dropped by Disney completely.
Yeah.
Because they don't mess around.
He's already been dropped by so many other, like,
he's been dropped by sponsorship.
Yep.
He's been dropped by his PR firm. He's been, nobody wants to touch this guy with a 10-foot pole.
Yeah,